From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! In 1944, General George Patton led the charge on Normandy. He called it Operation Cobra. When the U.S. military attacked Baghdad, they called it Cobra II. That's the name of a new book by Michael Gordon, the chief military correspondent for the New York Times, and retired Marine General Bernard Traynor, who also wrote for the Times. We'll speak with them about the inside story of the invasion and occupation of Iraq. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. U.S. and Iraqi troops have launched what the military is calling the largest air assault in the 3 years since the Iraq invasion. In a press release, the Army said over 1,500 troops and 50 aircraft have been deployed in a, quote, suspected insurgent operating area northeast of Samarra. Operation Swarmer is expected to last for several days. No casualties have been reported so far. A senior Iranian government official said Thursday his government is willing to engage in direct talks with the U.S. about Iraq. The U.S. and Iran have not discussed the issue since shortly after the U.S. invasion. An attempt to negotiate failed last year when Iran insisted the talks include other issues, while the U.S. said it would only address Iraq. In Australia Thursday, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice reaffirmed the Bush administration's stance.
Those talks are limited to questions concerning the country at issue. So in this case, it would be limited to questions concerning Iraq.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice in Australia on Thursday. In France, students are continuing to turn out in massive numbers to protest a new employment law that'll make it easier for companies to fire young workers. Police say the demonstrations have grown to nearly 260,000 people. Organizers put the numbers at over 500,000. Scattered violence has been reported around the country. In Paris, police used tear gas and water cannons against protesters at the end of a march outside the University of Paris, Sorbonne, on the Left Bank. Several cars were set ablaze and store windows were smashed during the unrest. Police have made over 200 arrests. According to the Education Ministry, two-thirds of France's 84 universities have been affected by strikes and sit-ins. In northern Iraq, hundreds of Iraqi Kurds protesting the regional government attacked a monument commemorating Saddam Hussein's 1988 gas attack on the town of Halabja. The protests occurred on the 18th anniversary of the attack. The monument was stormed after police fired gunshots over the heads of demonstrators blocking a main road. Demonstrators say they were protesting the corruption of the semi-autonomous Kurdish authority. The government has been accused of misusing funds intended for Halabja survivors. In Britain, two men are in critical condition after suffering violent reactions to a pill they took as part of a clinical study. Another four participants in the study are in serious condition. The study, run by the American drug research company Parasia International, gave the participants doses of the German drug TGN-1412. This is Mifanwi Marshall, the partner of one of the hospitalized men.
Face is bloated out. Like Elephant Man, like this. You know, it's all the blood, they're recycling his blood, trying to clean it out. You know, it's affected every organ, every his kidneys, his lung, his liver, his heart, his blood circulation, everything. And they're just trying to keep that ticking over with their machines. So he's on life support. And they're telling me he could die at any moment.
That was Mifanwi Marshall, the partner of one of the two drug study participants listed in critical condition. Here in the United States, a new congressional audit says the government wasted millions of dollars in its awarding of disaster relief contracts in areas affected by Hurricane Katrina. The Government Accountability Office's review was the first to look at the progress of 13 major contracts. According to the audit, the waste included a payment of $3 million for thousands of beds that were never used. In an update on a story Democracy Now! Covered Thursday, the University of Miami says it'll raise minimum wages and provide health benefits to its contract employees, including striking janitors and other workers. Some 200 janitors have been on strike for 3 weeks. The non-unionized workers, who are mostly Haitian and Cuban immigrants, earned as little as $6.40 an hour and were not provided with health insurance. Under the new policy, workers will receive a minimum wage of at least $8 an hour and will be offered health care benefits. Although the janitors officially work for a company named Unico, they were calling on the university to pressure the company to provide them with a livable wage and health benefits. While union leaders applauded the decision, they said the strike will continue to protest Unico's labor practices. The head of the University of Miami is the former head of the Department of Health and Human Services, Donna Shalala. In other news, a new poll shows a majority of Americans support Democrat Senator Russ Feingold's measure to censure President Bush for authorizing the no-warrant domestic surveillance program. According to the American Research Group, 46% of Americans favor the measure, while 44% oppose it. Feingold's widely publicized efforts stalled after it failed to attract the support of senators from either political parties. In other news, defense lawyers for indicted White House aide Louis Scooter Libby have subpoenaed documents from the New York Times, Time Magazine, and three other journalists, including Tim Russert of NBC News and former New York Times reporter Judy Miller. Libby stepped down as chief of staff to Vice President Dick Cheney after he was indicted in the investigation over the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. Libby's attorneys are asking the news organizations to turn over documents that could show what they knew about Plame before her identity was publicly disclosed. In other news, environmental groups are criticizing President Bush's nomination of Idaho Governor Dirk Kempthorne to run the Department of the Interior. A Knight Ridder analysis in 2003 concluded Kempthorne oversaw environmental degradation in several key areas, including air quality, rivers, and pollution inspections during his term as governor of Idaho. According to thinkprogress.org, Kempthorne has close ties to the same industries he would be responsible for overseeing. In his last reelection campaign, Kempthorne raised $86,000 from companies from the timber, mining, and energy industries. Philip Clapp, president of National Environmental Trust, said, quote, Dirk Kempthorne has been an unabashed champion of the resource extraction and development interests that profit most from public land. The president could not have chosen a more divisive nominee, he said. And as the invasion and occupation of Iraq reaches the three-year mark this Sunday, activists are staging anti-war events around the world. At least 500 protests are being held in the United States this weekend alone. United for Peace and Justice has organized actions in all 50 states. Some began earlier this week. A Veterans March for Peace, which began in Alabama Tuesday, will end in New Orleans. According to USA Today, a new poll shows 60% of Americans believe the war was not worth it. In London, the Stop the War Coalition will stage a Saturday protest to demand the withdrawal of U.S. and British troops from Iraq. Similar demonstrations are being held in cities in Iraq, as well as in Mexico, Japan, and other parts of Europe. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers. This weekend marks the third anniversary of the launch of the invasion of Iraq. On March 19, 2003, the United States began dropping bombs on Iraq while thousands of U.S. and British forces poured across the country's borders. 3 years later, the occupation continues with no end in sight. The U.S. military announced Thursday it launched its biggest air offensive in Iraq since the 2003 invasion. Over 130,000 troops remain deployed with no clear plan for withdrawal. The country is racked by daily bloodshed and violence, and the prospect of an all-out civil war is more real than ever. Now, almost 3 years to the day after the war started, a new book titled Cobra 2 details the inside story of the invasion and occupation of Iraq. The book is written by Michael Gordon, chief military correspondent for the New York Times, and retired Marine General Bernard Traynor.
Gordon was in the war room with Tommy Franks, Donald Rumsfeld, and various field generals during the planning and execution of the invasion. The book combines this firsthand experience with classified military documents, interviews with a range of officials, as well as findings from a classified report on Iraqi views on the war prepared by the U.S. military's Joint Forces Command. The report's based on interrogations of more than 110 Iraqi officials and officers, as well as over 600 Iraqi documents. Among what Gordon and Traynor found was that Saddam Hussein was convinced President George Bush, like his father, would not go to Baghdad, and they lay out how the Iraqi leader escaped from the capital. The book also finds Britain's top envoy in Iraq, John Sawers, expressed major concerns about how the U.S. was handling the occupation of Iraq as early as May 2003, just 4 days after arriving in Baghdad. And Cobra 2 exposes the tapes that then-Secretary of State Colin Powell played within a speech before the UN of recordings of Iraqi military officers in which one said, "I'm worried you could have something left." They expose that this was not referring to WMDs, as Powell alleged. Today we're joined by both authors of Cobra 2, Michael Gordon of the New York Times, and Bernard Traynor, retired Marine general and former military correspondent for The Times. They join us in the studio in Washington, D.C. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's good to have you both with us. If you, General Bernard Traynor, can lay out what you think were the five problems with the invasion as you lay them out in the book.
Well, I think you can be generally stated that there were erroneous assumptions made upon which the planning floundered. The ground attack went to Baghdad in record time. However, along the way, they ran into the sort of resistance that they had not expected. But if you're looking for the weak link in the process, it wasn't the operation itself, the invasion itself. It was the plan for the end of the invasion, and I use the term plan because a lot of people say that there wasn't any plan after Saddam's regime fell. But there was a plan, and the plan was for the United States military to get out of Iraq as quickly as possible, turn Iraq over to a U.S.-supported Iraqi government, on the assumption that the infrastructure, both the political and economic infrastructure, would be largely intact, and that the international community, the UN and others, would get involved in the post-Saddam period. That was a fatally flawed assumption, and as a result, a fatally flawed plan. So if you're looking for the problem that emerged with the insurgency, that would be kind of the fundamental principle. There were lots of other little mistakes that went through it, which turned out to be very large mistakes, disbanding the Iraqi army, not having sufficient American forces to follow on the invasion. As a matter of fact, cutting back on the forces that were involved in the invasion. And all of these things closed a window of opportunity of reasonable stability that existed immediately after the fall of Baghdad. But that window of opportunity only stayed open for a short period of time, and the slam shut and the insurgency emerged.
Michael Gordon, do you think the invasion itself was a mistake?
Well, that's a policy judgment and a political judgment that's really beyond the scope of our book. Our book is not about whether we should or should not have gone to war. The book is about how we went to war. And one thing that our analysis and reporting shows, as General Traynor said, is in the summer of 2003, and I was embedded throughout this period and in Baghdad then, I think most of the U.S. military commanders there thought that there was a chance to put Iraq on a better course had we done some things differently, had we had more troops, had we had effective nation-building policies, had we not disbanded the army. And it was the combination of these errors that created an environment which allowed the insurgency to gain some traction.
Michael Gordon, your book is especially critical throughout of the role of Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld. You talk about a variety of ways in which he directly participated in the planning and even when troops would be deployed, micromanaged the military at a level unprecedented. Could you talk a little bit about that and why you were so critical of Secretary Rumsfeld?
Well, you know, in our book, General Traynor and I, we didn't set out to do an investigation of Secretary Rumsfeld or General Franks. We just laid out the facts, and we had a lot of documents and a lot of interviews. And what the facts show is that Secretary Rumsfeld came to the Defense Department with an agenda. The agenda was to transform the American military. There's some good in that. We're not saying that's all bad by any means, but he wanted to create a force that could be basically lean and mean and carry out operations that would far smaller than, let's say, an invasion force that Colin Powell would put together. I think the force that he put together, he didn't actually order the generals to do it this way or that way, but he guided them through suasion, as one of his aides put it, by asking the appropriate questions, by demanding certain briefings, by sending down papers that he wanted the generals to read. But basically, the force that he established for the invasion was adequate for the task of taking Baghdad and getting there, although there were a few hairy moments along the way, but utterly inadequate for what followed, the so-called, what the military called Phase 4, but really the post-war operations. He was really a dominating presence, but, you know, General Franks, I'd say, was very much on the same wavelength, and the two, you know, basically collaborated to put together the plan. You know, one very interesting thing is that the Joint Chiefs of Staff were largely marginalized in this process, and in certain respects, the National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, and Secretary of State Powell were pretty much cut out of it, too.
General Traynor, you talk about the troika, President Bush, Vice President Cheney, and Rumsfeld making the decisions.
That's correct. That's the correct. The three of them were joined at the hip, if I can use that expression. They all thought basically the same way, and their perceptions became reality. I think the president, I would describe it as the man who presided over the troika. I think Vice President Cheney was very influential in terms of the policy, and certainly Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld was the man in charge of the execution of the policy. Everybody else was what I would describe as in the outer circle. The National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, and even the neocons, for which gained so much blame for things going wrong. But those people were in the outside of the private sanctum of the President, Vice President, and Secretary of Defense. Those three thought alike and acted in unison.
But interestingly, in terms of Secretary Powell, while he wasn't as much in the loop, according to your book, it wasn't so much that he opposed going into Iraq. According to some of your, I guess, interviews with Richard Armitage, the Secretary's thoughts were the invasion of Iraq should wait till President Bush's second term, after he had built more international support, and that he saw it as totally something totally acceptable, perhaps in the second term.
Well, I think you have to step back and look at the situation as it existed. The international community, all of the intelligence agencies, were all convinced that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. And this administration saw that as a threat that required preemptive action, because not that Saddam Hussein was going to pop a nuclear weapon or chemical weapon here in the United States, but he saw that after 9/11, the threat of amorphous terrorism, with terrorists getting chemical, biological weapons, and ultimately nuclear weapons without any national fingerprint on it. And how do you deal with something like that? So the policy was we have legitimate right to defend the United States. We have the responsibility to defend the United States. And in this instance, we have to preempt the Iraqis from providing the wherewithal to terrorists. And So that convinced a lot of people. It convinced the Congress, and it convinced the average man on the street that this was something that should be done. Obviously, there were certain people that did not agree, but the fact is the Congress supported the whole thing. The Secretary of State's position wasn't quite as crude as you describe it, as waiting for a second election. He wanted to give diplomacy a chance. It wasn't that he was opposed to going into Iraq. It was a matter of timing, and that's what he was insisting on. We see if we can't build up a coalition, whereas the Troika felt that they could pretty much act independently and a coalition would follow at the defeat of Saddam Hussein.
We're talking to General Bernard Traynor, who used to write for The Times, now is an NBC military analyst, and we're talking to Michael Gordon, chief military correspondent for The New York Times. They have written a new book, it's called Cobra II, The Inside Story of the Invasion and Occupation of Iraq. We'll come back to them in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 400 stations around the country, on Pacifica, NPR, low-power FM, community and college stations, public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410, Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're audio and video podcasting at democracynow.org, and transcripts are available there as well. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we continue our conversation with the authors of Cobra II, The Inside Story of the Invasion and Occupation of Iraq, Michael Gordon of The New York Times and General Bernard Traynor, who was with The New York Times, now an NBC analyst. You have a piece in this past Sunday's New York Times where you talk about what Saddam Hussein understood before the invasion. We want to ask Michael Gordon this question. What was the understanding before the U.S. invaded? How did Saddam Hussein prepare for it? And then the first attack of the United States on Iraq, being a site where the U.S. had hoped they were taking out Saddam Hussein.
Well, you know, one thing that's really fascinating is the extent to which each side misread the other. I mean, Saddam and his regime utterly misread the United States' political and military strategy, and vice versa, as we now know. And so these two sides, which miscalculated so greatly, kind of produced an outcome neither side anticipated. But Saddam's was the ultimate survivor, and his primary concern was internal security. He was afraid of a Shia uprising with some cause. There had been a Shia uprising right after the end of the Gulf War. And he wanted to keep a lid on that. And that was his major worry. And he took a number of measures to try to keep the Shia in line, which actually turned out to be completely counterproductive when the Americans invaded. For example, under penalty of death, he didn't allow his military commanders to destroy bridges in southern Iraq without his explicit permission. Why? Because he wanted to use these bridges to put down the Shia. This was very convenient for the Americans because they used the bridges to go to Baghdad. And to the extent he was focusing on an external enemy, he was worried about, somewhat ironically, the same enemy that President Bush highlighted in his recent national security strategy, Iran. I mean, Iraq had fought Iran in 8 years. Each side had used chemical weapons against each other. They had fired missiles at each other's cities. They were worried about Tehran. That was their principal thing. And the Americans, for the Iraqi regime, were really kind of a third-order threat. They certainly expected that there would be airstrikes. They thought the Americans might invade the South, maybe sit on the Rumaila oil fields. But what they really didn't anticipate, we now know from debriefs of the inner circle, Saddam's inner circle, by the U.S. military, they didn't anticipate the U.S. was going to drive all the way to Baghdad.
And then the U.S. attack and what happened, that first attack.
Yeah, that's really, again, a fascinating episode. And, you know, apart from all the policy stuff that we have in this book, really a large part of the book is just a group of very interesting stories and accounts of what actually happened that we don't really know, because in large measure this war was widely covered but not well understood. Well, on March 19th, George Tenet, the director of Central Intelligence, came to the administration, to the White House, and he said, the CIA is 99.9% sure they've got Saddam and his sons located at a site outside Baghdad called Dora Farms. This is the minute to strike. And so the president had to make the call. You remember there was a 48-hour ultimatum for Saddam Hussein to get out of Dodge, so to speak. Hadn't quite yet expired. They were waiting for it to expire. And so the White House was very interested in striking at Saddam, what would they would call a decapitation strike, to kill Saddam, and they thought end the war in one blow. Well, the White House decides to do this. The F-117 pilots at Abu Dayyid scramble to carry out this short order mission, a matter of hours to carry out a mission you normally plan for days. And they got to the site near Baghdad. It was a bit of a hazardous mission because dawn was beginning to break. And these stealth fighters, they're low observable on radar, but they're not invisible in the sky. And they hit the exact place they were supposed to strike, you know, on the button. And they got back, and everybody thought, hooray, we got Saddam, the war is over. And then about a couple hours later, this mysterious figure emerged on Iraqi television wearing these thick pair of glasses, reading some kind of speech. You know, in the United States, I was in the theater then, but in the United States, people thought, and the CIA thought, and the Bush administration thought, well, this is probably a double, doesn't look like Saddam. Saddam was obviously killed or wounded in the attack, and that was what the American government thought for a while. Well, we now know, because Saddam's personal secretary was captured and interrogated, that it actually was Saddam. He was nowhere near Dora Farms at the time of the attack. In fact, hadn't been there for years. And then he went to his personal secretary's house. He wanted to prepare a speech to the Iraqi people. He wrote it himself. There was no teleprompter, no cue cards, no printer. So he had to read it in his own hand, which he didn't normally do. He stuck on his pair of glasses. And so that actually was Saddam, very much alive and nowhere near the point of impact when those bombs fell. In fact, not only was Saddam not there, when American troops later got to the site and dug it up to investigate it, there was not even a bunker there. There was nothing there.
Who died?
Well, if you bomb an empty field, the results probably aren't very satisfying from a military perspective. They did totally obliterate the site with cruise missiles. I don't know who would have been there at the time, but if they were there, they undoubtedly didn't
survive. Well, one of the things that you raise in the book, I'd like to ask General Traynor about this, is that there was a decision in terms of a willingness of General Franks to accept collateral damage or civilian casualties, but that the rule was that if the expected casualties were greater than 30 civilians, that it required the approval of Secretary Rumsfeld himself?
Yes, Juan. You know, this really isn't unusual. When you draw up a target list, you have to prioritize it and put a value on it, and you have to match that that value of the target against other circumstances, which include collateral damage in terms of both structural damage and human loss of life. And you then make a decision on whatever metrics you want to use, and established in this instance, they used the 30 civilian casualty metric for very high value targets, and then you apply it with judgment at a specific time. This is not unusual, and just for the purpose of taking it out of the context of the of a disputed war, going back and say we had high value target named Adolf Hitler. and we knew he was going to be at Junction X at a certain date and a certain time, and there were going to be a lot of school children there waving swastikas at him. A decision would have to have been made by the president, President Roosevelt or Winston Churchill, as to whether or not the getting assured destruction of Adolf Hitler was worth the life of the innocents. This is a judgment call that only policymakers and their conscience have to make. So the setup for high-value targets in Iraq has to be seen in that sort of light.
And what about this, the whole issue of Paul Bremer's role and the provisional authority, the decision to dismantle the Iraqi armed forces? To what degree, and to purge all the Baathists, to what degree was that Bremer's policy? Was that fully supported by the White House of President Bush?
Don't you take that, Mike?
For me?
This is for General Traynor. Mm. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thought it was over to Michael. Yeah, the basic policy was to make use of the political, but non-Baathist, infrastructure, the civil service in Iraq, the police, and the army. Police to maintain stability and security in the country, the civil service to keep things operating, the military to protect and defend the sovereignty, the borders of Iraq, and also assist the police in stability and security. This was all part of the thinking of the U.S. military when they were in there, and indeed also part of the administration's thinking. But then the decision was made by Paul Bremer with kind of the amorphous approval of the Secretary of Defense, and there's no indication that the president and he's ever signed a piece of paper for the disbandment of the army. The administration says in effect that the army disappeared itself, that it dissolved. There was no army, so the business of getting rid of the army was simply putting a cap on what already existed. And to a certain degree that was true. You know, the troops went AWOL, deserted when they saw the war was over, but they could easily have been called back. As a matter of fact, they didn't even have to be called back. They returned for their paychecks, and they didn't get their paychecks, and they were pretty disgruntled. So now you have 300,000 plus with AK-47s out on the street, unemployed and pretty angry about things. It was a bad move, but it was done with the idea of eliminating the Baathist influence within the emerging post-Saddam government. And it turns out that after the studies of the makeup of the military at the time of the collapse, that there were relatively very few hardline Baathists that were in the chain of command, and they were clearly at the top and had been eliminated. So it was a terrible mistake. One of the major mistakes that went along with the others that upset the apple cart and prevented stability and security and services being restored in Iraq, and the invincibility of the Americans, who could get to Baghdad in a couple of weeks against Saddam Hussein's army, could put a man on the moon, now could not prevent looting, and could not restore services like electricity and the flow of clean water or protect national treasures. This was seen as a chink in the armor of the invincible Americans, that they were not invincible, in fact, and prompted the growth of the insurgency, and a lot of people who were either in support of the Americans when they first arrived and liberated them from Saddam Hussein, or was sitting on the fence to see which way it went, they were greatly influenced by the ineffectiveness of the Americans, largely because of the ineffective post-war planning policies, including the dissolution of the Iraqi army.
You talk about some of the mistakes, and I wanted to go now to some of the reporting by the media, which was certainly part and parcel of the whole lead-up to the invasion. And I wanted to go to Michael Gordon and ask you about that September 8th piece that you wrote with Judith Miller. The article that was on the front page of the New York Times that was cited by Dick Cheney when he went on Meet the Press, where you wrote from the beginning, you said, more than a decade after Saddam Hussein agreed to give up weapons of mass destruction, Iraq has stepped up its quest for nuclear weapons and has embarked on a worldwide hunt for materials to make an atomic bomb, Bush administration officials said today. In the last 14 months, Iraq has sought to buy thousands of specially designed aluminum tubes, which American officials believe were intended as components of centrifuges to enrich uranium. American officials said several efforts to arrange the shipment of the aluminum tubes were blocked or intercepted, but declined to say, citing the sensitivity of the intelligence, where they came from or how they were stopped. Can you talk about this really seminal piece that was cited by the administration, by senators and Congress members, deeply concerned about the possibility of, well, as they kept repeating, of a mushroom cloud? Your thoughts on your piece today?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked about that, because that's an important episode, and I've obviously thought a lot about it. By the way, that wasn't the only piece I wrote on the subject. I also wrote two other articles quoting the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Mohammed El-Baradei, saying that, in fact, there was no evidence from his point of view that the tubes were intended for nuclear purposes. And these articles appeared well before the war, as did El-Baradei's comments. But if you give me a minute or two, I'll explain the issue, because it's an important one. The CIA came to the view, which we now know to be erroneous, that the centrifuges had been intercepted, that they believed they were intended only for nuclear purposes. They had, and remember, this is not a defector, this is not a photograph of something that's happening on the ground that we don't quite fully understand. They physically had these centrifuges. They had intercepted them in Jordan, taken them someplace to analyze. We're the nation that invented nuclear weapons. So, you know, it's a fair assumption that you would think that if we physically have the evidence, we have certainly nuclear expertise in this country, you know, they would be able to diagnose what they were intended for. Anyway, the CIA took a very strong view on this, as did some of their allies in the intelligence community. And this was reflected as one of the key judgments in the National Intelligence Estimate that went to Congress. So, you know, if you took aside the whatever the New York Times wrote or others wrote, this is the heart of the National Intelligence Estimate that goes to the Congress, goes to the President. And in this, you know, what I now better understand is that while this was the kind of dominant view and certainly the institutional view of the CIA, there were a few other views within the intelligence community. The Energy Department did not agree that these centrifuges were intended for nuclear purposes. However, they didn't really take a clear stand on this because they also agreed. The same Energy Department that said the centrifuges were not for nuclear purposes took the view that Saddam was trying to revive his nuclear program for other reasons. So the Energy Department had a foot in each camp. The State Department experts in the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, they're the only part of the American government that completely challenged the view that Saddam was trying to revive his nuclear program. The Energy Department didn't do it. By the way, here's an interesting footnote. The British government, in a public report, more or less a few weeks later, challenged the notion that the centrifuges were for nuclear purposes, but then also asserted for other reasons that Saddam is reviving its nuclear program. So it was a kind of a complicated picture. There was no agency in the American government that said Saddam was not involved in WMD. You know, the State Department, although it's turned out to be correct, certainly on the nuclear issue, did not turn out to be, you know, didn't challenge the biological case, the chemical case. And I'm going to offer you this last thought, and I'm happy to respond to any questions you have. But, you know, there are a number of complicated WMD issues.
Let me just ask something on that. Are you sorry you did the piece? Are you sorry that this piece...
No, I'm not. I mean, I don't know if you understand how journalism works, but the way journalism works is you write what you know, and what you know at the time you try to convey as best you can, but then you don't stop reporting.
Well, and let me.
Can I answer your question since you asked me a question?
Well, no, I wanted to get.
No, wait a second. If you ask me a question, I'm happy to answer all your questions. But what I'm trying to explain to you is one thing. That was what I knew at the time. It's true that it was the key judgment. It's the same information they presented to Colin Powell, by the way, and it's what persuaded him to go to the United Nations and make the case on the nuclear tubes. I wrote the contrary case, giving the IAEA equal time. They disputed it. I don't have a dog in this fight. I didn't know what was the ultimate truth. When the IAEA came out in January and disputed it, I reported
it. Let me just respond. We have limited time in the
program.
Well,
then you should let me answer your questions.
But I did. And
no, you haven't let me answer your
questions. Are you sorry, then, that the New York Times was sorry that this piece appeared as it did on the front page of the New York Times?
I don't think sorry is the word the New York Times used.
Well, let me quote the Times. That in their piece that they wrote to the readers that said, from the editors, the Times in Iraq, that many referred to as the mea culpa of the Times. They said on September 8, 2002, the lead article of the paper was headlined, U.S. says Hussein intensified quest for A-bomb parts. That report concerned the aluminum tubes that the administration advertised insistently as components for the manufacture of nuclear weapons fuel. The claim came not from defectors, but from the best intelligence sources available at the time. Still, it should have been presented more cautiously. There were hints that the usefulness of the tubes in making nuclear fuel was not a sure thing, but the hints were buried deep. 1,700 words into a 3,600-word article. Administration officials were allowed to hold forth at length on why this evidence of Iraq's nuclear intentions demanded that Saddam Hussein be dislodged from power. The first signs of a smoking gun, they argue, may be a mushroom cloud. 5 days later, the Times reporters learned the tubes were, in fact, a subject of debate among intelligence agencies. The misgivings appeared deep in an article on page A13 under a headline that gave no inkling that we were revising our earlier view. The headline was, White House lists Iraq's steps to build banned weapons. The Times gave voice to skeptics of the tubes on January 9th. When the key piece of evidence was challenged by the International Atomic Energy Agency, that challenge was reported on page A10. It might well have belonged on A1.
Can I answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. I'm the person that wrote the IAEA story when they challenged it. I'm the person that suggested the New York Times cover it. I wrote it twice. The second time I wrote it with a reporter named Jim Risen, who you may have heard of. So I've worked with a lot of different people. This issue, this debate as to whether these tubes were intended for nuclear purposes was presented in a public forum in the United Nations well before the invasion. So everybody knew, the Congress, the American public, anyone who paid any attention to this, knew there was a debate. In fact, Colin Powell, in his presentation, acknowledged there was a debate among experts about the utility of the tube. The uranium is a very different issue. That's something that emerged after the war. Anybody who didn't know that there was a debate about the utility of the tubes, whether they were for nuclear purposes or for merely rockets, simply wasn't paying attention to the debate. This was all ventilated before the war. Had I had perfect information, and had I had many of these experts who have now, after the war, like Joe Wilson, decided to share their reservations with us, had they shared all of this with us at the time, I would have happily put in more caveats and dissenting views. But the dissenters were not dissenting to the New York Times at the time. But as soon as the IAEA went public with its assessment, I covered it. And by the way, if you know how newspapers work, I actually don't decide what goes on the front page of the New York Times. And I think the New York Times did its best and had no agenda, certainly, in this issue. In trying to cover this issue.
The dissenters themselves disagree, and they say they did contact the New York Times, for example.
No, I'm sorry, that's not true.
Let me make my point, and then you could answer it.
Okay.
For example, David Albright, who is the UN weapons inspector, and I am quoting from Michael Massing's letter to the editor responding to your objection to his piece in the New York Review of Books. Albright writing that the Times September 13th story, which you also also co-authored with Judith Miller, mm-hmm. was heavily slanted to the CIA's position, and the views of the other side were trivialized. Albright says, and this is the man who contacted the Times. Let me just quote for our audience. This is Albright saying, mm-hmm. an administration official was quoted as saying that the best technical experts and nuclear scientists at laboratories like Oak Ridge supported mm-hmm. the CIA assessment. These inaccuracies made their way into the story despite several discussions that I had with Miller on the day before the story appeared, mm-hmm. some well into the night. In the end, nobody was quoted questioning the CIA's position as I would have expected, he says.
Are you going to let me talk now?
If you could respond to that, please.
Yeah. You're not well informed on this issue because I don't have any, you know, criticism of you as an individual, but you're not very well informed on this because if you were well informed on this, I'm friends with David Albright. I think David Albright's an upstanding person who's doing very good work. I'm actually not Judy Miller, so I'm not the person he had the conversation with. But David certainly took the view early on, and he deserves a lot of credit for this, that the aluminum tubes were not intended for nuclear purposes. That's absolutely true. And as a person outside government, he did that analysis. However, and this is a very important point for you and your viewers to keep in mind, David Albright, at the very same time he made this analysis, believed Iraq was probably pursuing nuclear weapons. And at the very same time David Albright challenged the tubes, he published a paper on his website saying there was a suspect site at Al-Qaim in western Iraq that could possibly be involved in processing of uranium for nuclear weapons purposes. And I've talked to David about this. David's view was an interesting view, and it was a technical view. David believes Saddam was interested in nuclear weapons, and he might very well be pursuing them. However, David did not believe that the aluminum tubes were for that purpose. That's David Albright's view. And what people like Michael Massing and, unfortunately, you have done now is you've cherry-picked David Albright's view to make it look like it was clear to him that Saddam was not involved in nuclear purposes. David's view is very much like the British government. The British government believes that the tubes were not for nuclear purposes, but they took the position that Saddam was reviving his nuclear weapons program. So it was a complicated series of events, to be sure. But it's important to a lot of people in hindsight, reflect on, see their position as different than it was at the time.
But the tubes were key, and what was so important, too, was the timing. Vice President Cheney, of course, having the New York Times in front of him, saying, if you don't believe what I say, refer to the New York Times today. But going on with Massing's piece, referring to Albright, who did not believe that the tubes were being used for this, mm-hmm. though the Times did assert this, mm-hmm. Albright goes on to note that he wrote a series of reports criticizing the administration's claims about the tubes and its misuse of information to build a case for war, mm-hmm. and that these became the basis for an article in the Washington Post mm-hmm. on September 19, 2002, that disclosed the doubts some
paper.
Experts had about the tube's suitability for use in centrifuges. Mm-hmm. As Albright goes on to note, the Times' September 13th article, by carrying the categorical dismissal by senior officials of the dissenters' views, made these dissenters nervous about discussing the issue further. By contrast, reporters at Knight Ridder newspapers, after writing about the dissent in the intelligence community, began receiving calls from sources eager to talk. Thus, the Times' heavy reliance on official sources and its dismissal of other sources may have discouraged potential dissenters from discussing their views with its reporters.
Do you want me to say
something? Your response, please.
Yeah, I don't agree with that. And I actually, in the months of November, December, I actually wasn't in the United States. I was spent most of the time actually in the Arabian Peninsula area covering military developments. So I wasn't always present when all these things were unfolding. I don't agree that this discouraged them. I think these people never came forward. They came forward after, both after the war. The Washington Post did an excellent job, and so did the New York Times, of unraveling the tubes issue in great detail, talking to people who weren't making themselves available at the time. But I'm just going to make one. I think you can beat this dead horse forever, but I think I'm going to make one point. I, the same guy that wrote that story, wrote an article, two articles in early 2003 that said Mohammed El-Baradei, the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence, the British government, and the Energy Department all disagreed with the dominant view of the CIA that the tubes were for that purpose. And I wrote that on one occasion under my own name, and another occasion in a co-authored piece with Jim Risen. And these articles, if memory serves, appeared in the sort of January-February time frame. So, I mean, you can go check it on the public record, and it's all there.
The public record often shows this, but what isn't emphasized is where it appears in the paper. That was on page A9, page 10, much shorter article. And in fact, let me just make a point. Yeah. On that weekend that your first piece appeared, September 8th, that was the weekend that British Prime Minister Tony Blair and President Bush were at Camp David. Mm-hmm. And they talked about an IAE report that showed new information about the concern of Saddam Hussein getting weapons of mass destruction, particularly nuclear weapons. In fact, President Bush said, "I don't know what more evidence we need." Mm-hmm. Well, actually, any evidence would have helped. There was no such IAEA report, but few mainstream American journalists, including the Times at the time, questioned the leader's outright lies.
Can I, I never wrote the IAEA. I wrote the exact opposite. I wrote that the IAEA challenged it. I didn't say the IAEA supported it.
That's January. September at the time of your piece coming out.
Excuse me, I'm going to let you talk. You should let me talk. I wrote the IAEA assessment as soon as the IAEA made its public assessment. You know, I couldn't write what the IAEA's assessment was before they made it.
But you could have challenged President Bush at the White House.
I'm sorry, I wasn't at.
The Times could have challenged President Bush and Tony Blair, saying that a new IAEA report had showed that Iraq was 6 months away from building nuclear weapons, when in fact it didn't come out with such a report. And instead, the Times came out with a front page piece that very weekend, which was yours, talking about Saddam Hussein getting nuclear weapons, aluminum tubes.
I have an interesting thought for you to ponder along with the information I've introduced you to on David Albright. Larry Wilkerson, who I think you probably have interviewed him, he's a quite well-known figure. He was Colin Powell's chief of staff, right? You may have encountered him. Anyway, he's a very vocal person, and he's highly critical of the neocons and of the Cheney staff, and I've interviewed him anyway for my book, if you haven't. And he's also spoken publicly in press conferences. He's no friend of the administration, to be sure. Well, Larry Wilkerson went with Colin Powell to the CIA when they got briefed before Secretary Powell went to the United Nations to make his presentation. And Larry Wilkerson has publicly talked about this in press conferences before liberal groups in Washington, and also to myself. Larry Wilkerson believed that the tube evidence was persuasive after he got briefed by John McLaughlin and other people at the CIA, and Colin Powell, right, who did have reservations about going to war, also believed the information was persuasive after he was briefed at the CIA, even though his own experts at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research were challenging it. So, all I can tell you is that there was a very strong view in the American government, in the CIA, that persuaded Colin Powell and Colin Powell's chief of staff, the man who said a cabal was running our government, if you remember that comment he made some months ago, that same individual believed Iraq had WMD based on the briefings he got at the CIA. Now, I didn't create these briefings. They don't call me to the CIA to give them to me. I haven't, you know, participated in any of that. But, you know, all I can tell you is that there was a lot of confusion within the American intelligence community about what was happening in Iraq, but that the principal policymakers, including the man most skeptical about the reason to go to war, was ultimately persuaded about this and argued with al-Baradei and the Security Council about it. I agree with you in this, to the extent that I now believe, whether the CIA has retracted this or not, I think over time, based on what we now know, because we're in Iraq, we've debriefed the scientists, You know, we actually know a lot more than we knew before the war. We now, I believe that that CIA analysis is wrong. And I'm going to throw out one last fact for you to ponder. Saddam Hussein wanted the world to think he had WMD. We also know that. Saddam's concern was Iran. Saddam, he had fought a bloody war with Iran for 8 years. Both sides used chemical weapons. Saddam wanted to comply with the letter of the UN inspections, but he had a policy called deterrence by doubt. He didn't want the Iranians to know his cupboard was bare because he was concerned that would make him vulnerable to some sort of Iranian action. So he was walking a very fine line, and I understand what his political strategy was from Iran's point of view, but it certainly was misinterpreted back here in Washington.
Michael Gordon, to change the topic off of the aluminum tubes, in your book you talk about how the General Franks and his preparations, his year-long preparation for the war, discussed a lot the need to go after command and communications facilities, and that he actually referred them as media targets. Mm-hmm. There was, of course, the bombing of Iraqi television that occurred in the early days of the war, and you were actually on CNN where you were quoted as saying, and personally, I think that the television, based on what I've seen of Iraqi television with Saddam Hussein presenting propaganda, that I think it was an appropriate target. Mm-hmm. You're, in retrospect on that, that was condemned by many journalism or organizations around the world, the attacking of Iraqi television. Your thoughts on it?
Well, I think when, you know, I don't know it was in General Franks' mind when he meant media targets. I think General Franks has an odd way of talking, if you're familiar, if you've listened to him a lot or familiar with him, and he's not always, I don't want to cast any aspersions on him, but he's not always as precise in his language. I think by media targets in that context, really what he meant was command, control, communications. But here was the issue. In the first war, they knocked Iraqi TV off the air. I'm not calling, and I shouldn't be interpreted as calling, on the United States to bomb, you know, TV technicians. Some of my best friends are TV technicians. I don't care if they're American or Iraqi. I don't want people to bomb, you know, TV stations per se. But I think that one of the problems they were had was keeping Iraqi television off the air, either through electronic jamming or by, you know, if you can hit an antenna or, you know, hit a some sort of, you know, cable, or, you know, if there was some way of doing it. And the reason this became a big problem was because the Americans were invading Iraq. They were hoping that the Shia would help them and support them. And yet Saddam was on the TV all the time telling his public that, in fact, the Americans were losing and he was winning. And so when the American intelligence experts were trying to say, well, how come in these cities they're not rising up? Well, they weren't rising up for two reasons. One, he had the Fedayeen in these cities to kill anybody who rose up. That was a very, you know, that discouraged a lot of people from rebelling. And two, Saddam was on the air all the time. So what I believe is it would have been better if we had some way of knocking out that broadcasting capability, not through killing people in a television studio, but through electronic jamming, or if you could hit an antenna somewhere, you know, the kind of stuff they managed to do in the first Gulf War.
And General Traynor, finally, I'd like to ask you one quick question. In terms of the resistance, your understanding of how the resistance now in Iraq, is it largely a resistance of foreign fighters, or is it a domestic resistance to the occupation?
And we have 10 seconds.
Yeah, no. I think the foreign fighters have always been there, but I think they have been a small percentage as people that are probably mostly Sunni, who want to, it's a power struggle as to who's going to rule Iraq at the end of the day. And in a certain sense, the United States forces at this point are incidental to that power struggle.
And we have to leave it there. But Michael Gordon, quick question, and that is, do you think the Times was wrong to have printed their mea culpa and single out your piece as one that was less than rigorous and should, where they were sorry about?
You have a one-track mind. I thought we were going to talk about the Iraq War. But no, I think the Times was right to go back and look at the issue, and I think that, you know, with the advantages of hindsight.
We'll have to leave it there. I'm Amy Goodenough, Juan Gonzalez. We want to thank you both for being with us.